Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Opioid Use Disorder and Americans with Disabilities Act, Eliminating Discriminatory Barriers to the Treatment and Recovery conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, today's conference may be recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Peter Berg with the Great Lakes ADA Center. Sir, you may begin.
All right, Victor, thank you very much, and welcome to everyone that is joining us today. Today is the final session in the 2017-2018 ADA Audio Conference Series. So glad that all of you are able to join us for the session. The ADA Audio Conference Program is a project of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. You can locate your regional ADA center by visiting adata.org, or you can always contact your regional ADA center by calling 800-949-4232. As a reminder, again, this session is being recorded. The audio archive will be available within 24 hours, and in approximately 2 weeks' time, we will have an edited transcript posted to the archive page at ada-audio.org. So, again, welcome. We are pleased to be joined by two representatives from the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Civil Rights, Disability Rights Section, and we have attorney advisors Stephanie Berger and Savannah Watson. Savannah Weston, and both of our speakers provide regulation, interpretation, and coordination on the Justice Department's enforcement and regulatory requirements for the Americans with Disabilities Act and also Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. So we are very pleased to have them join us today on this topic that is of great importance, that being the opioid disorder and how the Americans with Disabilities Act comes into play and looking at how people with disabilities have protections under the ADA when it comes to recovery and treatment programs. So pleased to have Stephanie and Savannah with us, and I will turn it over to them at this time. Welcome.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Peter. My name is Savannah Weston, and my colleague Stephanie Berger and I are delighted to have the opportunity to speak with you all today about the application of the Americans with Disabilities Act to people with opioid use disorders. Moving to slide 10, slide 10 describes our objectives for today's presentation. So first, we'd like you to come away from this presentation understanding the ADA's protections for people with opioid use disorders. We also want to help you to be able to identify potential discrimination under the ADA that people in treatment and recovery from opioid use disorder may experience. And we also want to provide you with some information on how to file complaints with the Department of Justice or other appropriate federal agencies regarding discrimination. Moving to slide 11, this slide provides a roadmap of what Stephanie and I plan to cover today. So first, we'll describe the Department of Justice's response to the opioid epidemic. Next, we'll cover some basics about the ADA and its application to people with opioid use disorder. And finally, we'll provide information about how to submit a complaint, as well as how to reach us if you have any follow-up questions after today's session. Slide 12 is our alphabet soup slide, and it covers a lot of acronyms that we use in this context. So here are some of the key ones. ADA refers to the Americans with Disabilities Act. DOJ refers to the Department of Justice. MAT, or MAT, refers to medication-assisted treatment. And this is treatment for opioid use disorder, combining the use of medications such as methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone with counseling and behavioral therapies. Another acronym that you'll hear us use frequently is OUD, which is shorthand for opioid use disorder, as well as SUD, which is shorthand for substance use disorder. So slide 13 describes the Department of Justice's response to the opioid epidemic. DOJ is focused on prevention, enforcement, and treatment as part of this three-pronged response. Much of DOJ's efforts are focused on cutting off supply and bringing criminal prosecutions. But in this continuum, the disability rights section within the Department of Justice is focused on the treatment end of the spectrum. So our focus is on eliminating discriminatory barriers to treatment and recovery for people with opioid use disorder who are not currently using illegal drugs. And people with OUD frequently face discrimination and stigma related to being either a former or a recovering user of illegal drugs and related to the use of medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. And we think the ADA can be a really important tool when discrimination, which is frequently fueled by stigma or myths or stereotypes, serves as a barrier to treatment or sustained recovery. Slide 14 describes the tools that are available to the Department of Justice under the ADA, and this includes outreach, technical assistance, enforcement, and working with our U.S. attorney's offices across the country. Slide 15 and the next couple of slides that follow provide a quick ADA overview, and we know that many of you who have called into today's webinar are ADA experts. So we'll move relatively quickly through these next few slides, but they are important to cover because they lay the foundation for the discussion that will follow about the nuances of how the ADA applies to people with OUD. And in this slide, you'll see that the ADA prohibits discrimination on the basis of disability in employment, in state and local government, as well as in public accommodations. Slide 16 is our definition of disability under the ADA. Disability is defined as a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, a record or past history of such impairment, or being regarded as having a disability. So the physical or mental impairment prong is something that we'll discuss further in the slides that follow. The record of having such an impairment. So this would include a person who has a history of an impairment that substantially limited a major activity, such as someone who has recovered from an impairment. So an example would be people who have had a history of mental or emotional illness or a history of heart disease or cancer. And then the regarded as prong applies when people are treated as if they have an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, regardless of whether or not they in fact have an impairment. So here the perception is the key element of this. So people who perceive themselves as having an impairment but do not actually have an impairment and are not treated as if they have an impairment would not be protected under this test. It's about how others perceive that individual. So an example of someone that might fall under the regarded prong as having a disability would be if, based on a family member's HIV status, say a school district removed a child from its school because it regarded the child as having HIV based on the fact that they knew that a family member had HIV. So those are the elements of the definition of disability under the ADA. Slide 17 will focus more on an impairment. So opioid use disorders are impairments under the ADA. Individuals with OUDs that substantially limit one or more of their major life activities are generally considered to have a disability under the ADA. And the Department of Justice's Title II and III regulations specifically include drug addiction in the definitions of physical or mental impairment. But note, and we'll discuss this later, that this is subject to an important exclusion regarding current illegal use of drugs. Slide 18 describes major life activities, which include caring for oneself, learning, concentrating, thinking, communicating, working, as well as the operation of major bodily functions, including neurological and brain functions. And social interactions and parenting have also been recognized by some courts as major life activities that are affected by substance use disorders. So slide 19, to be eligible for the ADA's protections under Titles 1 and 2, the person must be a qualified individual with a disability. And this means that with or without reasonable modifications, the individual must meet the essential eligibility requirements for the employment, the receipt of services, or the participation in programs. So, for example, a person with an opioid use disorder seeks to participate in a state or local government program where the lack of a recent criminal conviction is a prerequisite for participation. And this person has a recent criminal conviction and is turned away from the program on that basis. This person would not be protected under the ADA for their exclusion from the program because he or she was not qualified to participate regardless of his or her opioid use disorder. This slide also covers the concept of mitigating measures, and that is the determination of whether an impairment substantially limits a major life activity is made without regard to the ameliorative effects of a mitigating measure. So an example would be an individual whose particular treatment allows him or her to fully function is covered by the ADA if, even without treatment, the individual's major life activities would be substantially impaired. So now we'll move over to slide 20. And this slide is to really focus on how expansive the definition of disability is under the ADA. So it's supposed to be interpreted broadly, and the question of whether an individual's impairment is a disability under the ADA should not demand extensive analysis. The term substantially limits should also be construed broadly, and the definition is a non-exhaustive list of major life activities. So then on slide 21, I've been moving relatively quickly through a lot of this material, and here's where I'm going to really slow down because this slide is important and it's kind of an important nuance in all of this. So under the ADA, an individual with a disability does not include an individual who is currently engaged in the illegal use of drugs when the covered entity acts on the basis of such use. So I'm going to break this down. What does it mean to be currently engaged in the illegal use of drugs? So first, what are drugs? Drugs are defined as a controlled substance, as defined in Schedules 1 through 5 of Section 202 of the Controlled Substances Act. So opium, opiates, and their derivatives are all considered drugs under this definition. And then what does it mean when the covered entity acts on the basis of such use? So if someone is currently illegally using drugs and the covered entity takes adverse action against them on the basis of their current illegal drug use, then that is not a violation of the ADA. However, if someone is currently illegally using drugs and the covered entity takes action against them, not on the basis of their current illegal drug use, but instead on the basis of their disability, then this could give rise to liability under the ADA. Moving to slide 22, this slide elaborates on what current illegal use of drugs means. So it's the illegal use of drugs that occurred recently enough to justify a reasonable belief that a person's drug use is current or that continuing use is a real and ongoing problem. Whether an individual's illegal drug use stopped long enough ago for the person to be protected under the ADA is really a fact-bound inquiry. But there are two key questions that you can ask that help inform this analysis. The first question is, does the illegal use of drugs remain a problem? And the second question is, how much time has passed since the individual illegally used drugs? And it really depends on case law in whatever federal circuit you're in. So some courts have interpreted current use of illegal drugs to include the weeks and months prior to the alleged discriminatory act. But some other courts have found that as few as 30 days free of using illegal drugs is no longer considered to be currently engaged in illegal use. So this is something where it really depends on the facts and the circuit that you're in for analyzing this. Moving on to slide 23. So does illegal use of drugs cover all opioid use? Does it cover MAT, medically assisted treatment? No. The illegal use of drugs does not encompass the use of a drug taken under the supervision of a licensed healthcare professional or other uses authorized by either the Controlled Substances Act or other federal laws. So, people who use opioids that are legitimately prescribed are not engaged in current illegal drug use. So, two examples. A person who's using opioids to manage chronic pain that substantially limits a major life activity, and those opioids are legitimately prescribed and taken under the supervision of a doctor or a treatment provider. The ADA would protect them. Also, people who are on opioid maintenance drugs, such as methadone, which is taken under the supervision of a doctor or treatment provider and part of a treatment program, they would also be protected under the ADA. But when entities take some action against or otherwise exclude people in these categories on the basis of one of these allowable uses, they may be violating the ADA. Slide 24 talks about the ADA does protect an individual who, and then there here are a couple scenarios, has successfully completed a supervised drug rehabilitation program and is no longer using drugs illegally, or has otherwise been rehabilitated successfully and is no longer engaging in such use. Another scenario is that they're participating in a supervised rehabilitation program and they're no longer using drugs illegally. And yet another scenario in which someone is protected under the ADA is if they're mistakenly regarded as using drugs illegally, but in fact they are not. So the common thread throughout these three examples is that the person is not currently engaged in the illegal use of drugs. Slide 25. Another important point to mention is that although the ADA generally does not protect individuals who are currently engaging in the illegal use of drugs, healthcare providers may not deny health or drug rehabilitation services to individuals because of their current illegal use of drugs if they are otherwise entitled to such services. So, while people who are illegally using drugs are not considered to have a disability under the ADA and therefore are not able generally to benefit from the ADA's protections, the ADA provides some protection when healthcare services and drug rehabilitation connected services are involved. For example, an urgent care clinic that treats all manner of medical emergencies cannot institute a policy whereby it would not treat medical emergencies related to heroin overdoses. Slide 26, it's also important to note a related issue to OUD discrimination, based on disabilities that frequently co-occur with OUD, such as mental health disabilities, HIV, and hepatitis. Many individuals have co-occurring disabilities, and so they may face multiple disability-related issues in connection with their OUD. And slide 27 is, we've heard of some instances where individuals who have mobility, vision, or hearing disabilities, in addition to having an opioid use disorder, have faced barriers to treatment. And such barriers may include inaccessible treatment facilities, such as a lack of ramps or accessible parking, as well as issues caused by the lack of auxiliary aids or services, such as not having a sign language interpreter at an opioid use disorder treatment clinic for someone who is deaf. With that, after slide 27, I'm going to turn it over to Stephanie Berger, who will cover the second half of our presentation.
Great. Thank you, Savannah. So now I want to dive a little bit deeper into some of the specific contexts in which discrimination might occur, starting with Title I, which is employment. So Title I, as I'm sure many of you know, requires employers with 15 or more employees to provide qualified individuals with disabilities an equal opportunity to benefit from the full range of employment-related opportunities. And that takes place everywhere from recruitment to pay, hiring and promotions, providing reasonable accommodations and other privileges of employment, and training. So now we're going to start, we'll have some examples throughout the rest of this presentation. Some of them are hypotheticals and some of them are actual cases. This first one is a hypothetical of what illegal discrimination might look like in the Title I context. So Eduardo is a checkout clerk at a local big box store and a model employee. But he has difficulty standing for long periods of time due to muscle pains that are related to his methadone treatment for his OUD. His employer refused to provide him with a stool as a reasonable accommodation so that he could sit down at the cash register when necessary until the muscle pains passed. So as many of you know, a reasonable accommodation is any modification or adjustment to a job, the job application process, or the work environment that enables a qualified applicant or employee with a disability to participate. And examples of reasonable accommodations can include making existing facilities readily accessible, restructuring a job, modifying work schedules, acquiring or modifying equipment, and even sometimes reassigning a current employee to a vacant position for which they are qualified. So once an employer determines that an accommodation is reasonable, the employer must provide it unless the employer can demonstrate that the requested accommodation would impose an undue hardship on the business operations. And determining whether a particular accommodation poses an undue hardship must be made on a case-by-case basis. So in this example, we can imagine, or we probably can't imagine too many situations where a cashier being able to sit at certain times would provide create an undue hardship on the business. So more than likely, allowing Eduardo to sit would be a reasonable accommodation. Another example to consider related to this would be a pharmacy that fears that its employees might steal drugs for illegal sale or personal use. And so that pharmacy says to address that concern, they want the employee to periodically report to the manager all prescriptions and non-prescription medications that they are taking. So would that be a reasonable policy? Probably not. The ADA prohibits employers from making inquiries of an employee as to whether that employee is a person with a disability unless the inquiry is shown to be job-related and consistent with business necessity. So the pharmacy's disability-related inquiry, where asking an individual what medications they take could very well require them to disclose a disability, would violate the ADA because it goes beyond asking about illegal drug use and is asking them for more information that would be likely to reveal the existence of a disability. One other issue that I wanted to address related to this slide is we've received many questions from individuals saying, would leave for an individual with opioid use disorder who wants to go to a treatment facility or take leave in order to receive treatment for their drug use be a reasonable accommodation. Leave to enter a rehab program may be a reasonable accommodation under the ADA for an individual with OUD. However, if an employee with OUD is currently engaged in the illegal use of drugs, remember that the employee is not covered by the ADA if the employer acts on the basis of their current illegal drug use. So what does that mean? It means that if an employer finds out that one of their employees is illegally using opioids, they are entitled to fire that individual, and they don't have to give them the opportunity to attend rehab or have leave to attend a rehabilitation program before firing them. However, as we also discussed previously, what constitutes current illegal drug use can be very fact-specific. Now, it is possible that an individual might request leave to attend a rehabilitation program without currently illegally using drugs. Some individuals may, for example, have a prescription to opioids or opiates that is valid, maybe perhaps related to an injury or another disability, and that individual may feel that they're becoming dependent on those opioids and want to sort of preemptively attend a program to help them get off of using that medication. So it is possible that a request to attend rehabilitation could be a reasonable accommodation that should be granted. Another question that we've received related to this is whether our position would change if the employee has an underlying disability for which they're taking the opioids. And once again, the key point there is that if an individual is taking opioids that are legally prescribed by their doctor, then they are covered by the ADA and they would be entitled to reasonable accommodations related to their disability. However, some individuals may both have a valid prescription to opioids and also be abusing opioids beyond their prescribed levels. And so, once again, that would be a fact-specific inquiry, but it may be possible that that individual would then not be covered under the ADA any longer. One other point I want to cover before we move to the next slide is what the difference here is between opioid use and alcohol use. So does the answer to the question change if it's treatment for alcohol dependency instead of treatment for opioid use disorder? And alcoholism and drug addiction are both disabilities under the ADA. The difference is that while a person with alcoholism that substantially limits one or more major life activities is covered under the ADA, whether or not they're currently abusing alcohol, a person with drug addiction who is engaged in current illegal use is not covered under the ADA because of that exception that we talked about before. So while it may, a person with alcoholism may be entitled to attend a rehabilitation program who is currently engaging in the excessive use of alcohol, a person who is currently engaging in the illegal use of opioids would not be entitled to the same accommodation. In addition, it's important to point out under all of this that employees can always be fired or reprimanded for failing to meet workplace requirements. And so if a workplace requires that somebody stay drug-free or alcohol-free or come, attend work in a timely manner and conduct themselves professionally, and because of their drug or alcohol use, they are not able to meet those requirements, then it would be acceptable for that person to be reprimanded or terminated. All right, that was a lot. Let's move on to the next slide. So here's another example of what illegal discrimination might look like. And this is an actual case, the EEOC versus Volvo Group, North America, which was in the District of Maryland. And this case settled in January 2018. And so what happened here is that an applicant alleged that Volvo made a conditional job offer to them and that they were qualified for a laborer position. And during the post-offer physical examination, the applicant alleged that he explained that he was taking medically prescribed Suboxone, And then, upon reporting for his first day of work, the applicant alleged that Volvo informed him it could not hire him because of his Suboxone use. And so what happened here was that Volvo failed to conduct an individualized assessment to determine what effect, if any, the Suboxone had on this individual's ability to perform the job. And the EEOC settled and made it clear that the failure to hire an individual with a disability just because they are a recovering drug addict in a medication-assisted program is a violation of the ADA. So under the consent decree in this case, Volvo will pay the individual $70,000 and take a number of steps, which include distributing a ADA policy, explaining the right to reasonable accommodation to the individuals in the facility where this individual was going to work, amending its policy on post-offer medical and drug evaluations to better explain how it will assess whether an employee or applicant's lawful use of prescription medication poses a direct threat as defined by the ADA, and also on how they will provide reasonable accommodations required under the ADA. Providing training, including on how the law relates to drug screening and the use of lawfully prescribed medications, and then a reporting requirement to the EEOC. There have been several other EEOC settlements in the past few years with similar fact patterns to this one, about five or six that we're aware of. And these are all cases in which an offer of employment was withdrawn when it was discovered that the applicant had opioid use disorder, either that they disclosed during a medical examination that they had it, or they were drug tested and it was revealed that they were taking lawfully prescribed medication treatment for their opioid use disorder. But even with a doctor's note explaining why they were taking it, the company still decided that they would no longer hire the individual. So now we're going to move on to talk about Title II, state and local governments. And as you probably know, Title II covers all activities of a state and local governments, regardless of their receipt of federal funding. So this is everything from courts to law enforcement services, public education, transportation, recreation, healthcare, social services, voting. And subject to the applicable defenses under Title II of the ADA, state and local governments are required to provide individuals with disabilities an equal opportunity to benefit from all of their programs, services, and activities. So on slide 34, we will get into some examples of what illegal discrimination might look like in this context. So the first is that a city adopts and enforces zoning rules that subject residents or that subject a residential substance use disorder program to a more burdensome approval process than the city requires of similar entities. DOJ has brought several cases to address discriminatory zoning and land use restrictions that act as barriers to treatment and recovery for individuals with substance use disorders. And so, for example, the department successfully challenged Baltimore's discriminatory zoning rules, which subjected residential substance use disorder programs to a more burdensome approval process that other entities were not subjected to. So this can sometimes take the form of just additional permits and additional processes that need to be gone through. It can also take the form of sometimes community forums are held and individuals in the community will say, oh, we don't want a methadone clinic in our area. And then that, you know, clinic might be subjected to additional levels of approval or have their permit rejected because of what individuals in the community said. So in the Baltimore case, the department alleged that the requirement to go through additional or sort of jump through additional hoops for that treatment facility discriminated against individuals receiving treatment in violation of both Title II of the ADA and under the Fair Housing Act. And the court found that the city's requirement was overbroad and discriminatory and actually ordered that the zoning code be amended. On slide 35, we have another example. So this is that a supervised release program prohibits people who are currently on medication-assisted treatment from participating, even if they're not currently illegally using drugs. So hypothetically, William would benefit from this program, but since it requires individuals to have completely ceased using MAT before participating, he's excluded. And we see and hear of a lot of different examples of these sort of blanket prohibitions on medication-assisted treatment. And the key here is always that a case-by-case assessment of individuals should be conducted. So blanket policies are typically not going to be acceptable. An individual should be able to have their need for medication-assisted treatment evaluated, looking at their treating physician's orders. And so the public entity would violate Title II by imposing eligibility criteria that screens out or tends to screen out individuals with disabilities. The next example on slide 36 is that a parole board prohibits inmates with a record of drug addiction from consideration for parole. And Jim, an inmate, has a record of drug addiction, but he's not currently illegally using drugs. And so an inmate with a record of drug addiction, a parole board would once again not be permitted to categorically exclude a class of persons with disabilities from consideration for parole because of their disability. So once again, the key here is conducting an individualized assessment of the individual. Moving to slide 37, another example in which opioid use disorder as a disability arises is child welfare. And so Title II covers child welfare agencies and courts' interactions with parents who are in recovery or recovered from substance use disorder and opioid use disorder. And once again, child welfare agencies and court systems should not subject parents to blanket eligibility criteria that screens out individuals with substance use disorder and opioid use disorder from participation in their programs, services, or activities. So we have heard of examples in which parents who are, especially mothers, who are taking medication-assisted treatment are told by the child welfare agency or the court that they need to stop using that medication-assisted treatment in order to maintain custody of their children. And this can be particularly challenging for women who recently gave birth because being on medication-assisted treatment is considered to be the gold standard for pregnant women. And so a woman may, you know, be very much encouraged by her doctor and the child welfare system to be taking medication-assisted treatment while she's pregnant. But then as soon as she gives birth, it's possible that her doctor would recommend she stay on the medication-assisted treatment, but the child welfare agency would tell her, if you want custody of your child, you need to get off of it. And so once again, the important key here is an individualized assessment of whether it makes sense for that individual parent to continue to take medication-assisted treatment. And the benefit of that parent's continued participation in medication-assisted treatment should be looked at, such as avoiding the recurrence of their illegal drug use, their improved health, and greater chances for employment, which all might weigh in favor of that parent staying on medication-assisted treatment versus any sort of ideas that the agency might have about why that parent should not be on medication-assisted treatment. For slide 38, we'll move to Title III, which is public accommodations. And looking at slide 39, we just have an overview of Title III, which covers 12 categories and places of public accommodation, which includes everything from pharmacies to insurance offices, professional offices of healthcare providers, hospitals, and social service center establishments, which are all categories where you can imagine a person having opioid use disorder might come into play. We'll move to slide 40. Which is where we can look at the example of the DOJ's first settlement in the opioid use disorder context, which is our settlement with Charwell Operating, LLC. And so in May of 2018, the Justice Department entered into a settlement agreement with this company, which operates a skilled nursing facility in Massachusetts. And in this matter, the charging party alleged that in 2017, the skilled nursing facility denied a bed to a patient due to that patient's use of Suboxone. So this individual needed skilled nursing for a different reason. I believe it was related to a recent surgery they had had, but they found out that individual was using Suboxone. And through its investigation, the department learned that this skilled nursing facility had not admitted any patients that had physician-prescribed medications, including Suboxone, or specifically medications for opioid use disorder, including Suboxone and methadone, at all in the past year. And so the department determined that Charwell's denial imposed eligibility criteria that screened out individuals with opioid use disorder, and that it denied the patient the opportunity to receive Charwell's services on the basis of disability in violation of Title III. And so looking at slide 41, the settlement agreement in this case required Charwell to adopt a non-discrimination policy, provide training on the ADA and opioid use disorder to admissions personnel, and to pay a civil penalty of $5,000 to the United States. So moving to slide 42, here we have another hypothetical example of a way that we might see illegal discrimination by a public accommodation. So DORA seeks to participate in a mentoring program for young adults through a local nonprofit agency. And DORA reveals, as part of the required personal background information, that she has struggled with an addiction to prescription pills, but she's proud that she's been 15 years completely drug-free. But the agency decides to reject her application based on her past substance use disorder. So here, the agency's rejection of DORA's application may indicate their use of a blanket policy prohibiting people with a history of substance use disorder from participating. And as we've discussed previously, blanket policies are typically a red flag because usually an individual needs to be assessed on an individualized basis. Looking at slide 43, so we've come to the end of all of our examples under the three different titles, and we want to provide you with some information on filing a complaint under the ADA if you or someone that you work with, we may experience discrimination in this area. We've heard quite a bit actually from providers of medication-assisted treatment, and from individuals who work with people who have opioid use disorder in all sorts of different contexts, that those individuals have issues and that they may be looking for a place to file a complaint. And so we would encourage you to share this information widely. So you can, of course, file a complaint with us at the Department of Justice. We have the information on the slide for where you can go to file a complaint. You can also go right to ada.gov, and you'll see, you know, a box right there on the homepage that says how to file a complaint. And just to provide a little bit of information regarding our complaint process, we receive thousands of complaints from the public each year, and we don't open investigations of every complaint, but we do thoroughly review every complaint that we receive. And if we do open an investigation, either by us or by one of our U.S. Attorney Office's partners, the DOJ conducts an investigation of the discrimination or the alleged discrimination, which can include requesting documents, witness interviews, meetings with the complainant, and all sorts of other things. And then if we find the ADA has been violated, we seek authorization to take action. And we always try to resolve in the first instance through a negotiated resolution. So we always try to work sort of more informally with a party before we take more formal action. If that doesn't work or the entity is unwilling to cooperate, we seek authorization to take other appropriate action up to including the filing of a lawsuit. So that's what to do, what the Department of Justice does with complaints. On slide 44, if the complaint is housing related, it should be filed with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. And so we have the information here for how to contact them. Probably the easiest way is to go on their website and look for that information there. And then on slide 45, we have information on filing an employment-related complaint. So the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, receives and investigates complaints regarding employment discrimination, including on the basis of disability. And so the EEOC and the Department of Justice both have jurisdiction to enforce the ADA. Individual charges need to first be filed with the EEOC, and then they investigate. And if they find reasonable cause that the discrimination occurred, they try to engage in conciliation with the employer to attempt to resolve the matter. If that fails and it's a private employer, then the EEOC will either file suit themselves or they issue a notice of right to sue to the individual to let them know they can go ahead and pursue their own lawsuit. But if it's a public employer, meaning if it's a state or local government employer, so an employer that would be covered under Title II, the EEOC then forwards that to the DOJ Civil Rights Division, and then we look at it and determine whether we want to take further action. In addition, the Department of Justice has jurisdiction not just based on these referrals from the EEOC, but also we can initiate our own investigation if we hear of potential systematic discrimination by a state or local government in the employment context. And so now we'll move to our last slide, slide 46, which is our contact information. We would encourage you to reach out if you have any questions after this presentation. And we are very happy to have had the opportunity to speak with you about this today.
All right. Thank you both, Stephanie and Savannah, for all of that great information. So now all of you have an opportunity to ask questions of our speakers. So before I bring Victor back to give instructions for those participating by telephone, I will remind those in the webinar platform that you can submit your questions in the chat area. And when you submit your questions, you will not see them, but they are viewable by us here, so we can ask those questions. So, Victor, if you would come back and give instructions for our telephone participants on how they can ask questions, please.
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then the number one key on your telephone keypad. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, that's star one for questions, star one.
All right. Well, we wait to see if we get any questions from our telephone participants, Stephanie and Savannah. Keeping along the lines of complaint filing, and just a couple questions around that area. First one is, you mentioned individuals, you know, filing online with the Department of Justice, and there's also information where folks can mail complaints through through old-fashioned traditional mail. What about U.S. attorneys' offices, which are part of the Justice Department? Can individuals go directly to a U.S. attorney's office in their local community to file an ADA complaint, or does it need to come through the disability rights section in Washington?
Yes, absolutely. Individuals can also file complaints directly with their local U.S. attorneys. Those U.S. attorneys can then, you know, go ahead and investigate those complaints themselves, or sometimes they will, you know, also loop us in, and we will be involved as well. So whatever an individual feels most comfortable doing.
Okay, and does the disability rights section also work with local U.S. attorneys offices that have experience in ADA complaints and investigations? Will investigations always originate out of D.C. or will complaints sometimes be forwarded from D.C. to the U.S. local U.S. attorney's office?
Yeah, so we have a great sort of collaborative working environment with our U.S. attorney's offices. There's 94 of them across the country, and So sometimes the complaints come in to us, and we will, you know, work with those local U.S. attorneys, especially in areas where we know there's a particularly big problem, and we know that, you know, there's a particularly active civil rights practice in that U.S. attorney's office. We often work very closely with them. So it just depends on the individual matter. Sometimes we do it ourselves. Sometimes we do it in conjunction with them, and sometimes they do it themselves.
Okay, great. And folks can find information for their U.S. attorney's offices, I think, through going to usdoj.gov. Or Google is always a good way to find contact information, a local telephone number if you put in a search for U.S. Attorney's office in a metropolitan, a large metropolitan city in your area. Okay, one more question on enforcement complaints. And this question relates to would the Justice Department, can someone file a complaint with the Justice Department if they have already or if they have a pending complaint in front of a state or local civil human rights commission? Would DOJ take a complaint in that circumstance?
Yeah, absolutely. Unlike some other civil rights statutes, there's no requirement for any sort of administrative exhaustion process or anything like that first. So we can, you know, go ahead and take a look at a complaint, regardless of where any other complaints that are made about the same issue are in the process. It would be helpful if an individual who files a complaint and does have a related complaint pending in another sort of forum would include information on that complaint when they make their complaint with us as well. That way we'll have a sort of a full picture of what's going on.
Sure. Okay. And one last one in this area. Can you talk about the DOJ mediation program and how you know, that may assist individuals in being able to resolve, you know, complaints around, you know, any opiate use disorder, you know, complaints.
The DOJ also has a voluntary mediation program. And so when we receive complaints, we screen them and we sometimes select ones that look like they'd be particularly helpful for mediation. And we have a mediation program coordinator who will then try to coordinate with the parties to see if that's a good complaint to go to mediation. I don't have all the information on our statistics on mediation right in front of me, but I know that we have quite a few complaints that go through mediation each year. And there is more information on our mediation program on our website at ada.gov.
Right. Yeah. Lots of information about that program. Okay. Let's check real quick and see if we have any questions on the telephone at this time, Victor.
Yes. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that's star one for questions. Star one.
Okay. We do not. So we will we'll check back to you. But let's continue with questions that have been submitted online. So this was a follow-up question to related to the example of an employment setting and related to the issue of being qualified. So the questioner wanted to know about, you know, what if someone was seeking employment in a drug treatment setting, so working in a treatment facility or a clinic, and they have either, you know, a record of you know, past use, and were denied an employment opportunity because, you know, that information was learned by the prospective employer.
Yeah, so I think this would be and yet another example where it's important to conduct a case-by-case inquiry. So, you know, there is the direct threat defense for individuals in employment as well. And so, you know, it could be that a person who has a past history of drug use or is currently using drugs might pose a direct threat in a healthcare setting or in a drug abuse treatment setting. It's possible. However, in the employment context, an individual or an employer would need to do that individualized assessment to really determine whether that person with opioid use disorder poses a direct threat to health and safety. And it would be based on the individual's present ability to safely perform the essential functions of the job. So if we're talking about a history of drug addiction, but they're not currently having any issues, then one would think that the likelihood of a direct threat being in existence would be relatively low. That assessment needs to be based on reasonable medical judgment and consider several different risk factors, including the duration and the severity of the potential harm and the likelihood that it would occur. So it's not an easy threshold to meet.
Great. And then a couple questions, individual questions around protection based on the association. So in a couple examples that they had, you know, one where, for instance, a child is, you know, denied participation in a child care program because of a parent's, you know, the center is aware that the parent has either a past history of substance abuse, or the parent is currently using medication, there is participating in a medication assisted treatment program. So what are the the protection there? The child is not someone with a disability, but they're the ones that are denied access to that that child care program on that basis. And then just another one related to one of the examples I think Stephanie you had brought up, regarding parental rights and the rights of parents with disabilities. So parents and one of the parents is, again, either have a history of drug use or medication assisted treatment program, and it's the parent without the disability that is denied, for instance, assistance or access to programs that typically would be provided to a parent in a particular situation. So if you could sort of touch on that association protections under the ADA.
Absolutely. This is Savannah. So under both of those instances, the child care program and the one parent having a history of drug use but another parent not having it, and in both of those instances being denied access to the program, those would both be examples of individuals being regarded as having a disability because of that association. So that would fall under the disability definition under the ADA, and they would have ADA protections for that reason.
Great. And then companions, you had talked about companions. This is a sort of different take on companions and effective communication. So let's say that someone that has an opioid use disorder was in a treatment program, a recovery program, and part of that involved participation of family members at some point during that program, and the family member, not the not the participant in the recovery or treatment program, that family member or friend who is going to participate in, let's say, a group session or some sort of counseling session, is an individual that is deaf and requires a sign language interpreter. What are the obligations related to the companion in that instance who is not the individual in the treatment program?
Right. So that's another great example of related disability issues that can come up in this context. So absolutely, an individual's companion needs to have their disability accommodated, whether it's providing a sign language interpreter for an individual who's deaf or providing materials in an accessible format for an individual who has any sort of vision disability. If a person has, if the program typically would involve a person having a family member or a friend participate in their treatment, then absolutely, if that friend or family member has a disability that requires accommodation or effective an aid or service to make that effective, then that would need to be provided.
And along those lines, just a follow-up related to a mobility disability. So let's say that someone is going to participate. Someone with a mobility disability is going to participate in an inpatient program or, you know, an outpatient clinic. And physical access, you know, is an issue. So it's not related to the opioid use disorder, but it's related to another covered disability. If you could, you know, just talk a little bit, you know, about, you know, program access and barrier removal and how that, you know, can come into, you know, touch this, you know, the main topic that we're talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're doing a great job of making sure we cover all the bases, Peter. Physical accessibility and program access, you know, remain important in this area as well. And individuals often have concurrent disabilities. And so absolutely an individual who has opioid use disorder may also have a mobility disability. And that program, you know, depending on whether it's a Title II or a Title III entity, has different obligations for what it needs to do in order to provide an accessible program. But those same obligations for either, you know, barrier removal or making the program accessible exist. And this is actually one great example where the issue of whether or not the discrimination is based on the individual's illegal drug use comes into play. Because it could be possible that a facility could say, well, hey, you know, we don't actually have to accommodate the person because, look, they're currently illegally using drugs. And you would say, well, no, in this instance, you're not trying to discriminate or exclude them because of their drug use. You're excluding them because of their mobility disability, because you're not providing access. So definitely these can get to be sort of interesting situations, and they're very fact-specific.
Excellent. And just, you know, a reminder that the ADA, you know, takes so many different angles. And for those that may be attending that, you know, operate, you know, run, you know, treatment programs that, you know, in addition to, you know, general non-discrimination policies, that there are, you know, ongoing obligations under Title III for, you know, barrier removal, no such thing as a grandfather clause, and program access for Title II entities, state and local governments that are operating, you know, clinics and inpatient, outpatient treatment programs. Okay, it would not be a Department of Justice audio conference or webinar program without a service animal question. You know, as in, you know, the immortal words of Sally Conaway, who retired from the DOJ, and there's always a service animal question. So to the extent that you're able to address this, and I know this is, you know, going to be very case-specific, but service animals, if you can talk about, you know, one, in outpatient settings and, you know, the obligations of treatment recovery facilities to accommodate, again, you know, someone using a service animal for a disability other than a, you know, opiate use disorder. And then if you could also, you know, kind of walk us through the scenario where in an inpatient setting someone wants to have a service animal with them, and what, you know, what might be legitimate defenses to, you know, possibly exclude, or maybe there aren't, you know, options to exclude. But if you could just kind of walk through the whole service animal definition, what entities can and can't ask, and how, you know, what how that would take place in an inpatient versus outpatient setting.
Sure. Sure. And so you are the first person who has managed to work a service animal question into our opioid presentation. So congratulations.
Thank you.
We'll do our best. So as most people have heard before, a service animal is under the ADA, a dog that is trained to perform a worker task that's related to an individual's disability. And so there are, you know, all sorts of requirements for service animals. They have to be housebroken and under the handler's control. They typically have to be leashed or tethered unless the person's disability requires that they not be. You know, entities typically cannot ask an individual too many questions about their service animal. So they can ask if it's a service animal and what worker task it's trained to perform, but they can't ask questions about the individual's disability. And so in an outpatient sort of setting, I probably can't imagine too many scenarios in which it would be appropriate to exclude an individual using a service animal. There is the sort of direct threat and legitimate safety requirements that can come into play. So if there was some sort of legitimate safety reason why a service animal would need to be excluded, or the animal would somehow provide or cause a direct threat, or the individual with a disability who's using the animal would somehow provide a direct threat because of that use, then that person could possibly be excluded. But as in every other setting, this typically tends to be a very high burden to meet in order to use either of those defenses. If it was an inpatient setting in a hospital, then typically a service animal needs to be allowed to go anywhere where an individual with a disability would go. There are some more sort of direct threat or legitimate safety requirements that can arise in that situation. So, for example, like a burn unit where it's extremely important for the atmosphere to be very sterile, it might make sense to exclude the service animal. But I would imagine if we're talking about an inpatient sort of treatment facility, there probably aren't those same sort of requirements for any sort of sterilization based on somebody's opioid use disorder. So I would imagine it would be difficult to prove why a service animal would need to be excluded.
Excellent. Thank you for addressing that. I am all about the service animals. All right. I know you you addressed this the issue and the distinction, Savannah, between someone who is currently illegally using drugs and alcoholism. But the follow-up question in an employment setting. So where would it be discriminatory, or take us through the analysis of a situation where an employer has a treatment program, second chance program for someone who has alcoholism, but they don't have a similar type of second chance recovery program for someone with an opiate use disorder?
Sure. So I think the key difference there, as we touched on before, is that there is that carve out in the ADA for an individual who's currently illegally using drugs, and that individual is not covered by the ADA. Whereas an individual who is abusing alcohol would still be covered by the ADA. So I think in this situation, it may be acceptable for the employer to have a different policy related to giving somebody who has an alcohol problem a second chance, but not giving a person who has an ongoing illegal drug use problem a second chance. And that's just because of that distinction within the ADA. Now, then the sort of question of what is current illegal drug use can come into play. And so the question may be, if the individual is currently illegally using drugs, then there's no question that the employer would be able to fire that employee without giving them that second chance. However, if the individual maybe has not been illegally using drugs for as little as a few weeks or a month, certainly if it's been a few months, then the law of that local district where the employer is might come into play as to whether or not they would need to provide them the same accommodation that they would provide somebody who has an alcohol abuse problem.
Okay, great. And again, you talked about policies. Just because someone, maybe a person with a disability because of alcoholism, in that instance, they would still have to comply with, all the employer's, code of conduct and performance requirements.
Right.
And Savannah, again, you also touched on, maybe it was Stephanie. I apologize, but you talked about very similar sounding. I can't wait till one of our students here has to go and edit the transcript. So you talked about general non-discrimination claim with regards to medical, you know, programs where it would be discriminatory, urgent care for someone to, you know, turn away someone, you know, based on a service that or treatment that they particularly provide. But could you talk about the, you know, provisions of the ADA that talk about, you know, specialty. So let's say that, why or why not, it would not be here, why it wouldn't be discriminatory per se for an urgent care center to refer someone to a trauma center that is experiencing, you know, for instance, an overdose, or where a general practitioner or clinician may refer someone to a specialist, you know, for treatment related to an opiate use disorder?
Sure. So I unfortunately don't have that provision right in front of me, so I can't quote it directly. But it is sometimes appropriate for a facility to refer an individual to another facility that could better provide the services as opposed to directly serving themselves. So whereas it would not be appropriate for, you know, an emergency department to turn a person away who's having an overdose, it might be appropriate for them to say, you know, we can't provide you with a drug treatment program here, but we can refer you to a hospital that does have a drug treatment program.
All right. Very good. And you talked about this, but just I think in a different context a parole board that has a particular policy, but this questioner wants to know about in some states where it prohibits, you know, incoming inmates to be participating in it, you know, or taking medication, you know, that's medication-assisted, you know, treatment program. They don't allow, you know, inmates as a general policy to enter their prison system if they're using, you know, medication-assisted treatments.
Sure. So that's another thing that we're hearing a lot about. And in fact, the ACLU currently has a case in Massachusetts, and I believe another one in Maine, sort of challenging some prisons' policies of, you know, not having, you know, people who come in and they're already on medication-assisted treatment, not providing that medication-assisted treatment or requiring them to detox. And that is an area that the Department of Justice is not currently active in. So it's certainly our position that that prisons and jails are covered by Title II. But this is not an area that we're currently active in, but we would absolutely encourage people to continue monitoring the efforts of other organizations.
Excellent. Thank you. And then this question regarding effective communication. Again, obviously a lot of issues related to, you know, individuals, as you mentioned, you know, can have more than one disability. So someone that, you know, is deaf or hard of hearing, or someone that is blind or low vision who is seeking, you know, treatment from a program, and what those what are the obligations for those healthcare providers, whether it's Title III, you know, to ensure effective communication, or it's Title II and primary consideration. If you can kind of, you know, walk us through those obligations to, you know, be able to effectively communicate with someone with an opiate use disorder who is deaf or hard of hearing or blind or low vision, and conversely, the ability of that individual that's seeking treatment to be able to, you know, communicate effectively with the folks that are providing the treatment.
Right. So so both Title II and Title III entities have the obligation to provide effective communication to individuals with disabilities, whether they're if they require effective communication through auxiliary aids and services, either for vision disabilities or hearing disabilities or any other disabilities that might require those. When it comes to Title II, so state and local governments, they need to typically provide the type of aid or service that the individual requests unless they can demonstrate for a reason like an undue burden or hardship in providing that. A Title III entity just needs to give consideration to an individual's request. So since Title III public accommodations might have, you know, slightly more limited resources than a state or local government would, they have a slightly lower burden in providing exactly what the individual request, but they should certainly make every effort to provide that individual with some sort of aid or service and to do the best that they can to provide that effective communication.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And I'm sorry if I missed that, but did you explain the primary consideration under Title II and that distinction? And if so, I apologize for...
Sorry, we cut out for for a minute. You know, Peter, you might actually be better suited to explain that difference. I don't have it right in front of me.
Okay. The primary consideration is that state and local governments, when Congress was passing the ADA originally, the congressional record testimony, clearly indicates that state and local governments have a higher obligation when it comes to effective communication. Not that Title III entities, don't have an obligation, but there is a higher obligation, and the Title II regulations actually use the term primary consideration. So the obligation is to provide what the individual has requested, whether that's a qualified interpreter or real-time captioning, and a state or local government entity can only provide an alternative where it's going to be equally effective. But in either case, the best case scenario, whether it's Title II or Title III, is to talk to and have a discussion. There's nothing wrong with asking, questions and understanding what's going to be most effective in a particular situation in order to communicate with someone that's deaf or hard of hearing or who has low vision. So.
Thank you. You were far more articulate on that point than I would have been.
Let's see here. We've got here's a question here, and it sort of gets to the definition, and you may not be able to answer this specifically, but talk about again just the overview, I guess, of someone with an actual disability. So the question wants to know about someone that who through proper use of a medication becomes addicted to said, let's say, pain medication, and what, if any, protections an individual would have in that instance. So let's say it's in an employment setting. Someone is, and if this is too specific, obviously, so someone is taking prescribed pain medication and they become addicted to that, and an employer becomes aware of it because they randomly do drug testing or something along those lines.
Sure, that's a great question. So if an individual has an underlying disability for which they were prescribed opioids as pain medication by their doctor, but in the scenario you've described, they have now developed an addiction and they're taking opioids in addition to or in beyond the amount that were prescribed for them by their doctor, then they may be considered to be engaging in current illegal drug use, and thus would not be covered by the ADA.
Excellent. And then obviously, like you've mentioned multiple times today, that those are going to be really, case-specific.
Absolutely. It's a fact-bound inquiry. Oftentimes it depends on whatever circuit you're in and looking up the case law for. So, yeah, it really does depend on the facts.
Okay. And another question back to, sort of enforcement. Obviously, you talked about, Stephanie, that, Justice Department just simply doesn't have the resources to enforce all complaints. But the areas where the Justice Department Disability Rights Section has engaged in enforcement activities, have those, obviously you can't give specifics, but have those come from individual complaints? Have they come from, disability rights, network, formerly Protection Advocacy Services? Have they come from, Justice Department? The Justice Department has the authority to do compliance reviews. So if you can just, sort of talk in terms of, how those enforcement efforts are born.
Sure. Do you mean related to the opioid use disorder
yes.
cases specifically? Yeah. So
specifically, yes.
In this context, we really are relying on our outreach efforts quite a bit because what we're finding is that a lot of individuals, so traditionally, if somebody, you know, there's no ramp and the person has a mobility disability or, you know, the person isn't provided an interpreter and they're deaf, they make the connection that's a disability issue, and they, you know, either know about the ADA or they do a quick Google search and up pops ADA.gov, and so they figure out quickly how to file a complaint. In this context, it's a little bit different because a lot of individuals don't realize that drug addiction is a disability under the ADA. A lot of people don't realize that opioid use disorder falls under that bucket and would be a disability that's protected under the ADA. It's not the first thing that comes to people's minds. And so we're finding it's a little bit trickier for individuals who are facing discrimination to figure out how to have their rights vindicated. So that's why we've been trying to do a lot of outreach in this area to have individuals file complaints. We are getting some complaints from some individuals. We have also, as you mentioned, you know, tried to partner with disability rights organizations and local organizations to try to make sure that they get the word out so that either they themselves or they can tell individuals about this and they can file complaints. And so that's definitely the primary thing that we've been doing here.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question related to an individual with an opiate use disorder who is being released from prison, and as part of that must enter some type of community program or housing shelter where that program is specifically designed to assist individuals who are being released from custody and assisting in that transition to get people back within the community, and where those, for instance, you know, they have policies that, you know, prohibit any type of drug use and monitoring of, you know, any medications, but where the policy, again, prohibits that, where someone may be taking medication, they're participating in a medication-assisted treatment program. So a policy that would not allow someone access to that sort of transition program in the community.
Sure. So we're finding that a lot of those sorts of cases are actually covered by the Fair Housing Act as opposed to the ADA because most of them tend to be, you know, at least a slightly long-term situation. People tend to live there for a little while, and so they're then covered by the FHA instead of the ADA. But certainly the same sort of blanket prohibition on medication-assisted treatment always is a red alert or a red flag that there may be some sort of discriminatory action occurring.
All right. Very good. Well, we are near the bottom of the hour here, and so I want to thank both of you, Stephanie and Savannah, for joining us today. Not just for the time that you spent, presenting today and answering a myriad of questions and my service animal questions, but for the time that you spent in preparing for the session and practicing. So it is truly appreciated, and the ADA National Network as a whole appreciates the great relationship that we have with the Justice Department and the ability to collaborate and work with you and serve as a conduit out in the field. So we appreciate your time with us today. If you have additional questions, there are ways to get in touch with the ADA, Department of Justice ADA hotline. Lots of great information is available on ADA.gov, as both Stephanie and Savannah mentioned. On the ADA.gov homepage, they have a section there, What's New, and that's where you will see postings of recent enforcement activities and information about any new technical assistance guidance information. That's where you'll find it on that homepage. It's also there where you can access all of the technical assistance and requirement documentation, the regulations. You can link to all of those on ADA.gov. As a reminder that today's session is being recorded, has been recorded, and the audio archive will be available within 24 hours, and we'll have an edited transcript up within 2 weeks' time. Wanted to remind folks that we will be kicking off our 2018-2019 ADA Audio Conference season and October the 13th. Please be aware that that is a special date. Typically, the audio conferences are held the third Tuesday of the month, but due to holidays and holidays in November and December, we have moved the October session up to October 13th is still the third. No, getting a little ahead of myself. The session in October is on the 13th, and we will be looking at the right to vote, access to for people with disabilities, and we will have a presentation on HAVA and the ADA and the rights of persons with disabilities to not only get into their polling place, but to be able to cast a private secret ballot just as any other individual is able to do so. So you can find information. That session is open for registration right now. You can find registration information by visiting ada-audio.org. That is also the location where you can find the full bios for both Savannah and Stephanie, and that is also where you can access the archive of today's session, as well as the archives of all of our past audio conference sessions. If you have questions about this program, you can contact us by calling 877-232-1990. And as always, you can locate your regional ADA center by visiting adata.org. So once again, I want to thank all of our attendees. We do these programs because of you and because you have an interest in these programs. You'll be sent out an evaluation following today's program. We encourage you strongly to complete that. That helps us evaluate the program. It helps us get ideas on what types of topics and sessions would be of interest to you. So ask you to complete that evaluation that you will be asked to do so. So again, thank you to Stephanie and Savannah, and Savannah and Stephanie for joining us today, and to all of our attendees, good day.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone have a great day.